This is the continuation of session one.
We're going to do about a half hour meditation, first death meditation, and we'll go through a very brief preliminary. So I'll go through the preliminaries in a very quick way. Encourage you, if you don't know the preliminaries or how to start a good meditation, then bring a tape recorder tomorrow for the early session especially, and I'll go through them again. And then what you can do is follow it when you're doing your own meditation. You see what I mean? At home. And it's a good thing to do every day. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom, and it means to get used to something by doing it over and over again. And this meditation will not affect you much unless you do it over and over again. And if you do it over and over again, then you'll get to Chiwadhamma, Chiden. And it's very, very sweet state of mind. I can't describe it enough. I can't really give you the sense of it, but it's like being at a festival or something. And your whole life, you know, Benjamin Franklin called it a continual Christmas, and it feels like that. It feels like Christmas every morning, you know. And you get up, and your mind is clear, and your life is clear, and no junk, and you know it, and you feel good, and you feel right about it, and there's this joy all day long, exhilaration all day long. Okay, so you know, it's not what you thought when you saw the advertisement for a death meditation, right? So it's very exciting. Okay, so here we go. Get into proper meditation posture. If you don't know, then go to Kadampa Center and ask them to teach you. All right. Basically, right leg on top of left leg. If you do a half lotus, which is all I can do, get your shoulders straight horizontally. I carry this heavy briefcase, so one shoulder's always like that. Head should be erect like that, straight, you know, forward like that, as if you were looking at Viviana, and then put your eyes down a little, you see what I mean? Then you get that neat Buddha look, you see? And okay, so don't put your head down, don't put your chin down, but have your, just normally, not too high either, but not, you know, like a soldier, and then your eyes down like that in contemplation. Okay, if it bothers you to see things, then close them. But if you can keep them like halfway open and just unfocused, that's ideal, because then you won't get so sleepy. Then left hand down first on your lap, and right hand on that, palm on palm. And first watch your breath. Watching your breath means watching the feel of the breath in the inside of the nose, okay? And try to take rather deep breaths, okay? Try to breathe rather deeply and then release it in a very relaxed way and try to get all the air out, okay? So don't force too much, but take a good deep breath and then take a good deep breath out. And then we'll do that for a while. We'll watch. And then stay in there, and I'll be leading you through the preliminaries and then into your first death meditation. We got this jello that you have to eat just before that. No, okay. First step is to take refuge, and taking refuge in this case, we can just think of the difference between worldly refuges like money, family, food, and think about the other refuges like being prepared spiritually to die. So compare in your mind worldly refuges and then spiritual refuges that can help you after you die or as you die. And we spend just a few breaths thinking about that, and then we move on to the next preliminary. And these preliminaries set your mind up for meditation. Next preliminary, think about bodhicitta. Think about someone who needs something physically, mentally, ill or sick or some other kind of problem, and think about being able to help them. Someone specific. Next preliminary, invite a holy being before you to meditate with you. Anyone you consider especially holy, the Dalai Lama or Jesus or Lama Sopo or whoever you can imagine that you feel very close to. And bow down to them mentally, which means to think about their holy qualities, something about them that you can recognize even in your current, at your current level, and think about how holy they are for that. And praise them mentally. Make some beautiful gift to them, some beautiful offering, something beautiful that you can see or feel, or like a flower or the ocean or the side of the moon. If you don't have, if you like, then the holiest offering you can make is something about your practice that you're working hard on, and that's the one that pleases them the most. Sometimes I make it in the future because I haven't done it yet. Okay. Think about something negative you've done or said or thought about someone in the last 24 hours or so, and admit it and see how wrong it was. Now something positive, rejoice in something right you've done, something good you've done in the last 24 hours, even if it was small. Make it specific, some specific word you said to someone, specific thought you had. And ask for teachings, some kind of good teachings. Can be formal teachings or something someone teaches you, someone in your family or someone at work that teaches you about patience or teaches you about compassion. But ask to stumble across these teachings. And last preliminary practice is to think about your Dharma teachers and other kind teachers throughout your life, and also your Dharma friends, the ones who influence you in a good way, and to pray for their long lives and pray that they stay near you. It's a lot of what we are is determined by who we stay near. That concludes the preliminaries, and usually if you need to scratch something or move your leg or something, then it's a good place to do it right now. And then we'll start the actual meditation. When you're by yourself, this is where you can shift a bit, okay? The preliminaries make your mind clean and ready to meditate. Okay, now we'll start the real meditation. So go back to your breath. And we'll be doing what's called a shargam. And shargam is a kind of meditation where you review a certain series of steps, a series of thoughts over and over again until they become second nature for you. And it's very good to connect it to what they call mnemonic device or some kind of picture that you can follow and remember where you are. Like if you're memorizing a text in Tibetan and you have trouble, you can connect each chapter to a different part of your hometown and you go from house to house and it's easier to memorize a long text. And they use that in the monastery. So we're going to connect the death meditation to a picture and we're going to be moving from place to place, and then each time you come to a new place, you'll remember that oh, that's where I'm supposed to think about that, you know. Those of you who did the Lamrim Mandala, we entered from the west side of that place, and now go to the east side, right? Same, the place we're going is the same. And so imagine that you're in a place where there's a large building, almost like a castle, and it's made of earthen brick, and it stands on a almost like a small island, and in the center is an open courtyard, and around the place is a moat like a water, and then on the far side of the moat, that on that bank is an empty clearing, and then forest begins. And this will make it much easier for you to do the meditation. It's a lot more fun, and you can remember it easily. Imagine that you are struggling to the forest. It's thick forest. Very, like, wild forest. Very hard to get through. And you're carrying all these things, like a heavy backpack, and a lot of, like those soldiers in Private Ryan, you know, all this junk on them. And imagine, like, a big canteen and a sleeping roll and all these things hanging off you and heavy, and you're trying to get through the woods, and then you break out into the clearing in front of the moat. Okay, so you're standing there in a clearing and you're tired and you're hot and sweating and you're dirty and have all these things hanging from you, and it's heavy and you're tired. And then there's a bridge crossing the moat into the building, and you're on this side of the bridge, the far side, and just in front of the bridge at the opening is like a table, tables covered with food and drink, and there's a big mass of people are milling around, and you're thirsty and you're hungry and you're hot and you're tired and you have all this junk on you, and you're trying to reach some of the food and the drink, but there's many people, and and it's hot and it's crowded and you're having to push people out of the way to get to the drink, and you do, and you're pushing people out of the way, old people, young people, and you're trying to reach these things. And think about, while you visualize that, then think about living a life of a person who doesn't remember death, who doesn't recall death, and who has no death awareness, and they're just grabbling after small things, petty things, and hurting other people while they're doing it, okay, and collecting bad karma while they waste their life, okay, and that represents the first part of this Lam Rim, the first meditation, which is on the problems of not remembering your death, okay, and you're just grasping after small petty things of this life and hurting other people to get them. So next time you do this meditation, you connect that to the table and the food and the people milling around. And the junk on your back is all the unnecessary possessions and unnecessary relationships and unnecessary activities that you're engaged in that don't really make you happy. They just fill up time. If you have time, identify the possessions, you know, like the backpack is the house mortgage payments that are weighing you down. And the canteen is big and bulky, and that's your car. And, you know, connect it to things like that. Next Lam Rim, the next part of this Lam Rim is to think about how good it would be to have a good death meditation. And here you're breaking out of the crowd and you're making your way towards the bridge, like a drawbridge that's going over the moat. And you're like tired of that scene. You're tired of living like that, and you're breaking out and it gets thinner and thinner, and then you finally made it to the bridge. And that whole bridge is going to be the next step in the meditation. It's very useful for memorizing where you are. And these are the benefits of divesting, you know, the benefits of a good death meditation. And then go across the bridge slowly. Take junk off your back, off your belt, off your chest, and throw it off into the water. And it represents getting rid of those unnecessary, those extraneous possessions, extraneous activities, useless things that you work for and spend your time on. And, you know, take the New York Times especially and throw it off. And all those things, television, you know, one big, you know, albatross around your neck, and throw it off, and things like that. And just start throwing them off and feel lighter and lighter as you cross the bridge. Give each object a meaning in your own life. Then we're coming to the end of the bridge, and you're very light now, but still pretty dirty. and scratched up from the forest and still tired. And then you come to the end and there's imagine some people with like a gauntlet, a few violent guards of the place or something, and you're going to have to get through them. And there's some kind of big rough guys with knives or swords or some kind of blades, and you start to pick up speed and you burst through them and you get through them. But that represents the normal fear of death, okay, which is a lousy death meditation, okay, and that represents the third part of the outline, which is what is a good death meditation. You know, what would it be to have a good death meditation? So first we get through the wrong one, which is to be afraid of death, like to fear it in a normal way, in the way of a person who's suddenly faced with a life-threatening situation and they're reduced to some kind of knee-jerk reactions to save their life and afraid, or a person who just found out they have cancer. I went once with a student who was going for an AIDS test and thought they had AIDS, and it was very cruel. They made a mistake on the first try and said, "We think you have it," and then come back in half an hour and we'll try again. And the second one was clean. But the whole experience of fear and panic, that's not death meditation. And you want to, that's the next step in the Lam Rim. The next meditation is to overcome that fear and drive past that fear and not think of death that way. So we break through that kind of negative death meditation. You break through these people with the knives and they don't touch you. And then suddenly it's as if you took a bath and you're very clean and you smell good. Your body's covered with some kind of scent. I like personally an amber scent or a sandalwood scent, and your body's totally clean and you feel light and strong and happy and you're covered with these light clothes like silk, and there's a grassy section in front of the building that we're going to enter a door, but before that door there's this like meadow, beautiful grass, and you're just dancing across, like very light, very happy. And that represents a good death meditation, the kind of death meditation we want to do, which is really just some kind of unencumbered feeling. Every moment living as if that was your last moment and feeling free and unencumbered by things you don't need or activities you don't need to be doing, and feeling light and happy and lean and dancing across that meadow. Okay, and so that's represents the goal of a good death meditation. And then you're standing in front of a door, and that will be the beginning of how to do the death meditation, and we'll be studying that tomorrow. Now I'll go one more time quickly through what we've been through. We've been through four steps of death meditation so far. First one was coming out of the forest weighed down and struggling with the people at the table and hurting some people on the way. And this is what happens to you if you don't think about your death or you don't believe you're going to die tonight. And then crossing the bridge and getting lighter and lighter was the benefits of doing death meditation and divesting yourself and feeling lighter lighter and lighter as you go, and being happy that way. And then the third step was the people with the knives and the meadow together. That's number three, okay? And that's what is a good death meditation. And it's not the people with the knives. It's not being afraid of death and worrying about death and being panicked about death. Rather, it's the meadow of feeling. A person with a good death meditation is feeling free and happy and light and joyful and vibrant, feeling that you have that you're doing the right thing and you're not wasting your time. And every day is like a big Dharma party, and feeling like that, okay? That's the third part of the death meditation. The knives and the meadow are the third step, which is the right way and the wrong way to do a death meditation. Or what the goal is, the state of mind. The state of mind that we're not trying to get and the state of mind we are trying to get. Now, and tomorrow morning in the afternoon, we'll enter the building, which is the actual meditation. And it will have nine different steps there inside the building, okay? Now the traditional way to end a meditation is to think of that holy being who was in front of you that you're meditating with, and you beg them to come into your heart, and the idea is that they rub off on you if you carry them around in your chest all day, okay? So the scriptures all say the same thing. They get very excited. They say, "Oh, you want me in your heart? Thank you." And they get smaller and smaller, and they start to rise up in the air, and then they come down on your head. You feel a little light landing, like a helicopter, okay? And they turn around the same direction that you're sitting in, and they're very small by now. They're like 3 inches high. And then you ask them to come into your heart, and they come straight down like an elevator shaft in front of your backbone. And they get smaller and smaller. And they're coming down a small tube until they reach the level of your heart, right? It's not in your heart, it's behind your heart towards your backbone, maybe half an inch in front of your backbone. And make for them a little beautiful place there, like a little cathedral, like a little capsule, and very beautiful, quiet place with, they're sitting on a huge flower, like a huge rose, and in the middle of that is a beautiful mattress made of pure, warm, golden light. And then they're sitting there, and there's fragrant smell, your favorite smell, like McDonald's French fries, amber or something. And then they're sitting there very happy, and they're like radiating strength into your bloodstream, and the whole effect of their body, their holy mind is going through your body like your blood. And they stay there all day long. Anytime you need them, you just stop what you're doing and think about them, and they're there. The last step of this meditation is to dedicate the virtue and think of the light coming out of the blood and bursting out of the pores of your skin, and like a flash of light, brilliant rays of light going out, and all the good karma of talking about death, all the good karma of all the sweet people who made this center, from Lama Yeshe to Lama Sopa, and all the people, dedicated people who built this place and keep it going, and thinking about all the good karma of having all the classes that have been held here, and all that energy going out to touch other people, like a big ripple effect through other, and imagine all that karmic energy centered in this place, holy place here, and going out and touching other people and helping them. Okay, then we'll do a short prayer. Okay. Okay, thank you. And there'll be a quiz. The way the quiz works is that we take half the homework questions. Okay, so your homework is very wimpy, okay? It's not like New York homework. It's like 2-3 questions. So one of those questions or 2 of those questions will be on the quiz. And you have to buy into the deal, okay? That's the deal. Like, I never charge, but you have to turn in your homework. You got to do the quiz. It's not for me, it's for you. And you'll thank me by Sunday night. You say, finally I learned something. Now I remember all the steps of this meditation, and I know what they are, and I remember why they're there, and then you can really do it. So just buy into it. Don't resist it. Just do it. You'll have a quiz tomorrow, and you have a small meditation assignment for tomorrow morning, and that's on your homework, okay? And ask you not to miss more than one class. Okay, that's the deal I have. I don't charge anything but that. You got to come to 4 of the 5 classes. You got to do homework. Got to do the quiz. Okay, all right, deal. In the diamond business, we say mazal. Okay, mazal is my holy word of honor. And once you get mazal, you're gonna pay for sure. And no one ever breaks mazal. We don't have written contracts in the diamond business. It's very interesting. No lawyers, no nothing. It's all trust. So you got mazal here? Okay.
This is the end of session 1. Session 2. Sashi Bhuti Jushi Neto Sham Vira Vinci Ninde Yampadi Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Jogunanda Shimba Jibashu Idam Radamata Kamiyataya Sangye Chadam Sangye Chonama Chanchu Badu Dagni Kyasuchi Dagi Chunyen Bipe Sunangi Dora Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chadam Sangye Chonama Chanchu Vadu Dami Kasushi Dagi Chunyen Dipe Sunangi Jola Penche Sangye Jupasho Sangye Chudam Sangye Chudama Chanchu Vadu Dami Kasuchi Dahi Chunyen Gibe Sunangi Yola Kenshi Sange Juhashu.
Okay, we'll start. If you remember, we got out of the forest and you had all this junk on you, and then you reached the like tables, and there's this big crowd of people trying to get things, and you're shoving people out of the way. By the way, you can also think of them trying to grab the things off of you, and you're like an Indian bus, you know, like, I always said I would never act like that. You know, I saw Indians getting into a bus, and I said, I will never do that. And then when I had to get to, what is that place? Pathankot, from Dharamsala, and I stood through three buses and couldn't get on, and then I started, you know. But it's like that. Think of yourself. You're trying to get things, and they're trying to get things from you, and you're hurting each other, okay? And then you break out of that, and you're starting to cross the bridge. That's the meditation on the problems of not meditating on death, okay? And then you break out, and you're starting to get across the bridge, and you start divesting things, okay? And relationships and activities that you do, things that you do, and getting rid of them. And that's crossing the bridge, and you're like throwing things off into the water, and you feel lighter and lighter, and then you get to these scary guys with big knives and swords, and they represent the wrong kind of meditation on death, okay? You're not supposed to meditate just to get paralyzed, okay? The purpose of death meditation is not to stay in bed all day and, you know, decide that everything's hopeless or something like that. That's not a death meditation. And then you do you get the real feeling of what a death meditation would be by dancing across the meadow before the door. And it's nice, and you're all light, and your body is light, and all you have on is some light silk things, and you're able to dance right across, and you feel the like empowerment or joy of not having too many things, and knowing that your mind is clear and your life is clear, and that you're concentrating on the most important thing you would do if you're going to die tonight, you know, and you get that feeling of how it would feel. And really, if you really do it, it's very, very pleasant. Okay, if you really, really get into that state of mind every day, that you're only doing the things that you think are important if you're going to die tonight, it's very, very pleasant. It changes your whole life. You feel no guilt, you know. It's like chocolate without sugar, you know. And there's just no guilt at all. It's like you just feel very clean and happy, and you know that you're doing the best thing you could do, and you feel very happy, and your whole day is happy. And then if you keep it up over a few months or a year, then also, your activities purify. You know, you're only doing the most important things, and you know it, and you can see the effects of it. And, you know, if you're doing really heavy Dharma things, then the effects on other people and the effects in your own life are very noticeable. If you cut out all the, excuse my language, crap, then you feel very light, and you feel strong and powerful, and you feel like you're finally doing the right things, and you know it, and it's a really nice feeling. And there's a slight period of adjustment, like a slight period of missing the things you used to do, or people still calling you up to do stupid things, and you know, there's a slight period, but and that's what you're afraid of before the death meditation, and then after it happens, it's done, and they all think you're crazy, and everything's fine, you know, and your life is straightened out. So there's a little, I can't deny that there's a little bit of a discomfort thing there, but it's much less than dying, you know. you think now it looks pretty serious to you, but after you get over that hump, then it just, you look back and you think, that was nothing, you know, and you don't remember all the things you used to do, and you don't miss them much at all. It doesn't take more than a few weeks to forget about them. But right now it looks like this insurmountable thing that if you gave up those things, people wouldn't like you, or people would think you were irresponsible, or, you know, or, and then once you get over, like, you do one or two disengagements, the rest are easy, okay? So you just have to start the first couple. So that's and getting to the first door. Now we're supposed to enter this place, this structure, okay? And I'm going to repeat, there's three principles for death meditation. So when you go through a death meditation, it goes through three principles. We'll cover one now, and we'll cover two this evening. Is that the way it goes? Two now and one this evening. Who's got that thing? You got that thing? Yeah. No, the homework. Anyway, we'll cover them today. First one. There's three principles for death meditation, and they go, each of them has three rationales, okay? So it'll be 3 times 3, it'll be 9, all right? So a good death meditation has 9 main lam rims. Lam rim, remember, can mean the whole path, the stages of the path, but lam rim can also mean, lam ki rimba means each step is called a lam rim. You see what I mean? So when a lama says lam rim, you got to ask, are you talking about the whole lam rim, or are you talking about each separate lam rim? See, because each stage, like death meditation, is called a lam rim, meaning a step on the path. And then lam rim means the whole steps on the path. And you never know which one they're saying. You know, often they'll say lam ki rimba, the long one for the steps themselves individually. And then they'll say lam rim for the whole path made up of steps. But anyway, you got to get used to that. So I'm going to talk about 3 lam rims. And inside of those are going to be 3 lam rims each. So you got 9 sections to your meditation. And we'll take you through the building. Okay, the object is to get to the central courtyard, okay, which is like enlightenment. All right, but we're going to use mainly a death meditation to get there. So when you visualize it as like a structure, it's easier to remember. So you'll be going through certain rooms, you'll be going through certain hallways, and there'll be certain things there to remind you where you're supposed to meditate on. And then what you can do is stop at the one that you want to concentrate on. You can either do a shargom, which is where you go through all 9 steps pretty much in order in the 23 minutes before work, or you can go through 4 of them and then stop at one and spend, 20 minutes there and then go on to the rest. Do them very briefly. It's good to do all 9 briefly. It's like a series of exercises, and then you stop on one and concentrate on that, and then you do what we call chegom, which is an analytical meditation. So shargom, a review meditation, means you'll go through all 9 stages in order, but you'll chegom on 1 or 2 of them, depending on how much time you have to meditate. So you can take a stop and do an analytical meditation on one of them. They say in the lam rim to do an analytical meditation on the one that you have trouble with. Okay, the one that you're not so convinced of. Okay, and you stop on that one and work on that one. So you take them in order. You're going to go through all 9 steps of the meditation, and then you're going to think about which one do I really have trouble with? Which one is hard for me personally to deal with? And then you stop at that one and you do a chegom. And chegom means you set that one in front of your mind primarily, and then you work on that one for a while. And you argue with your own mind. Chegom means arguing with your own mind. You know, the devil and the angel, you know. And and you say, you accuse yourself. You say, you don't really believe you're going to die tonight, do you? And you say, no, I haven't died tonight for a long time, you know. And and then you start arguing with each other, you know. And he says, well, look, you're still like only, oh, boy, it's getting on. You know, and then he says, then let the argument go like that. And watch your mind, and you'll catch your mind being stupid. And it's very upsetting, actually. It's sort of depressing when you finally hear your mind's most intelligent arguments against death meditation. They're so stupid that you feel stupid, because it is your mind, after all. Okay, so so we'll go through I'll list the 3 principles, and then we'll go through the 9, what they call the 9 reasons, okay? We did some of them the other night. This is, for those of you who can't see, it's Chiwa, C-H-I-W-A, Ngepa, N-G-E-P-A, C-H-I-W-A, N-G-E-P-A. Say Chiwa,
Chiwa.
Ngepa,
Chiwa,
Chiwa.
Ngepa.
Have to die. Ngepa means definite. Chiwa means die. Okay, Chiwa Ngepa means you gotta die, you must die. Okay, have to die. That's the first principle of a death meditation. Okay, for those of you who can't see, it's Nam, N-A-M, Chi, C-H-I, Mange, M-A-N-G-E, M-A-N-G-E. Say Nam Chi,
Mange,
Nam Chi,
Mange.
Nam Chi Mange means, and it's not definite at all when you have to die, okay? The timing is anything but definite, okay? So the first principle is you have to die. The second principle is it's totally uncertain when you're going to die. You don't know when it's going to happen, okay? Could happen any moment, okay? Nam chi mange. there's these texts in the Tengger. We're typing in all the Buddhist texts, and we get to this book, and I get the data from India, and I'm checking it, and it's like stops in the middle of a sentence, and I like ask my lama, you know, what's going on here? He says, there's a few books like that in the Tengger. The guy died halfway through writing it, you know, halfway through a sentence, you know. And they just carved it up to that half of a sentence, and they stopped, and they start the next book, you see. It's really weird. There's a couple books like that.
Okay.
For those of you who can't see, it's Chi, C-H-I.
Tse, T-S-E.
Ch, C-H-U. Matok, M-A-T-O-K. Mipen, M-I hyphen P-E-N. Say Chi Tse.
Chi
Tse. Ch, Matok.
Mipen.
Chi Tse.
Ch,
Matok.
Mipen.
Chi Tse means when you die, and at the moment of death. Chö means Dharma, your spiritual level, spiritual teachings. Mato means nothing else. Mipen can help you, okay? Except for whatever spiritual things you've been able to develop in your life, nothing else can help you when you die, as you die. Nothing else will be of any help to you when you die, okay? Those are the three parts of a good death meditation. So we'll be going through all three of them, and each one will have three justifications. All right, there's three justifications for each one, making a total of nine. So a good death meditation has nine main stage lamrims in three divisions, and then just before that you go through those three preliminaries, meaning thinking about how bad it is not to meditate on death, which we finished, right? That was before the bridge. And then thinking about how good it would be to be a good death meditator, and advantages of it, which is the bridge itself and dumping the stuff off. And then thirdly, the right way to meditate on death and the wrong way to meditate on death. And the wrong way is to like be paralyzed and frightened and freaked out and morbid and depressed and all that, which is the guys with the swords. And then the right way is to dance across the meadow, which is like, you know, when you really are a good death meditator, meaning you always act in your life, your daily life, as if you were going to die tonight. It's like some kind of freedom, and you feel totally guilt-free. You feel like really that you're doing the right thing, okay? Even if you die at that point, it's a very easy death. You see what I mean? And it feels much better. And again, there's this initial resistance to it. There's this initial fear of really doing what you want to do, and giving up the things that you have now. You see, I mean, they used to say at my job, there were two kinds of executives where I used to work, and they were clearly two different types, and it was a huge company, it was 800 people, so we had lots of different personalities, many different people, and there were these some managers who needed to hang on to their position, they were very attached to it, and they would actually defend it, you know, they wouldn't teach anybody what they were doing, they would never be sick, because they'd be afraid that somebody else could learn what they did and replace them. They had this thing about fear of being replaced, and they would like protect their territory. And then they'd always end up like having an ulcer, and they'd look terrible, and they were tired, and because they were just constantly struggling to make sure they had their position. And whenever there was a layoff, they'd get laid off first. It's the weirdest thing, you know what I mean? And they'd figure out what they did within a day. You know, like it would take like a day to figure out what this guy's doing. Usually it wasn't too much, you know. But they'd have a few systems that only they knew how to turn on and only they knew how to run, and they would make sure nobody else learned, and they thought that was security. And then there's these other guys who, you know, the boss would say, I want you to teach someone else your position. And then they wouldn't say anything. And then you'd go home and you'd say, maybe they want to fire me. Maybe they're trying to set me up for something. And then you'd say, it's okay. I'll just teach them anyway. You know, because it's good for the company. You know, even if they want to get rid of me, I guess they've determined that's the best thing for everybody else. So this is very bodhisattva, you know, like, okay, so I'll teach this guy everything I know. And the boss isn't telling you anything, you know, so you're getting nervous. You go home at night and you wonder if you're doing the right thing. But anyway, you teach somebody else everything you know. They're cheaper than you. Okay? I mean, you know they get $10,000 less or something. You know what I mean? And you're like, You know, okay, and you teach them, and then suddenly the boss calls you and says, you know, this other guy can do your job, and you're like, yeah, I know, and he's cheaper than you too, and you're like, yeah, I know, and he says, well, I got this other job for you. I'm going to give you a raise, give you a transfer. This is a higher position, and the other guy can replace you because now you're replaceable. And then those people would keep moving up in the company. It was really weird. You know what I mean? And it was some kind of freedom from fear that made them successful. It was some kind of ability to let go of what they used to be so they could become something new. And that's very hard. Death meditation is like that. Like, it's very hard to redefine yourself. It's very hard to give up what's comfortable and what's known to you. But if you think about it, you won't have time to move up unless you give up something. You see what I mean? You won't have time to be available for the next promotion. And this is exactly in corporate life. It was exactly like that. The people who made themselves redundant or the people who had what we call succession plan behind them because they cared about the company would keep moving up. You know, and the people who were selfish and didn't want to let go of what they used to be were always what they used to be or fired. You know what I mean? Or laid off, actually. And so it takes some kind of courage, and it also takes like intellect. You have to understand that if you don't let go of some of your activities, you won't be free to do higher ones. You see what I mean? And it doesn't matter where on the Dharma ladder you are. You know what I mean? Unless you're at the top. Okay, that's different. But if you're anywhere else on the Dharma ladder, you always are faced with this choice. You know, it's one thing to get on the Dharma ladder. That takes a lot of effort. But once you're on, you're constantly faced with the choice of letting go certain. There's a bodhisattva vow called doing deeds of lesser benefit. You know what I mean? Not to do deeds of lesser benefit. Meaning, when faced with a choice, you're always going for the higher good. You see what I mean? Because once you get on the Dharma ladder, until the day of enlightenment, you're constantly faced with these choices. You know, you have to give up what you used to be to move up. And it necessarily means giving up some of the activities you used to do, some of the practices you used to do, that are comfortable for you. You know, you took a lot of time to memorize this book and you like to recite it every day. But you can't do the next one up if you don't let it go sometime. You see what I mean? And you can't have both. You see, you can't memorize for 4 hours a day or 6 hours a day. You have to move on. You have to move up. And you can't do that until you let something go. So especially in a death meditation, they're really cool because when you divest, then it leaves you free for other things. You see, I mean, every time you give up an object, or you give up a relationship that's not as important, or you give up some activity which is not really very important, then you get a little crack of free time open for the next higher thing. You see what I mean? So you can't move up if you don't give up something. You won't have time to do both. You know, normally we try to do the old thing half as well as we used to, and then do the new thing half as well as we could, just so we can possess both of them. You see what I mean? And no, you got to give up, okay? You got to move on, all right? Spiritually, you have to keep moving up. Okay, and that's getting up to the door. That gets you up to the gate. So far we have three preliminaries, really, okay? Which is before the bridge, thinking about what happens if you don't meditate on death, which means you become this grubby little person who's just interested in getting a little more food or a little more money or a little more fame or something like that, okay? And hurting others on the way, okay? And then the second thing is divesting, how good it feels to meditate on the benefits of death meditation. That's crossing the bridge. And then the third part, we're talking preliminaries, right, to the nine. The nine are going to come later. Third part being the guy standing at the bridge, which is a stupid death meditation, and then flying across the meadow, which is a smart death meditation, and a liberating death meditation, okay? So we got up to the door. Now we're going to start the three justifications behind saying you have to die, okay? And so I'll write those up here. And then we'll meditate on them. Okay, number one is Lord of Death is unstoppable. And this is the first part of the meditation. We'll be going into the door and there'll be something there and we're going to think about it. But anyway, the principle is that death cannot be stopped. You know, you can, and your mind says, no, you can. You know, you get a really good doctor, they do a heart surgery, it's successful, death is stopped. You know, like you were supposed to die, but death is stopped. Couple of problems with that kind of thinking, okay? One is that nothing can really stop your death. You see what I mean? And you have to think about karma and emptiness. Okay, that was the very first subject we ever had here, the marriage of karma and emptiness. And all of these meditations, if you can inject them with an understanding of emptiness, then it'll be much easier for you when we get to the very end, just before we break into the courtyard. Okay, so we'll keep bringing it up throughout. Okay, what is the death and empty? What has karma and emptiness got to do with this? You see, I mean, you have to understand that life itself is a... Now, here's the emptiness of life itself, okay? The fact that you are alive is a projection of your mind, okay? This is just a cylinder with five kind of crooked cylinders, in my case, at the end. And then when you look at it, it's alive, okay? The fact that you see it as alive is something coming from your mind. Okay, it's something that's being projected from your mind, and when you see it die, when you see it stop moving, that will also be a projection from your mind. Okay, and you have to get used to that. That's how karma works. The fact that you are perceiving these five cylinders and the long cylinder like an arm rather than like a tree branch, which is, you know, or like a, something dead on the ground. The only difference is that your mind is making you see it like that. You see, I mean, your mind is forcing you to see it that way. And there'll come a time when it dies, your mind will force you to see it that way, as not moving anymore. Like, there is a short period as you enter the bardo where you're aware of your body. They say you float above the body and look down, and it's kind of like that, according to the Buddhist scriptures. And there will be a time that you can look at these cylinders, and they won't be moving anymore. They'll be what you call dead. But whether they're dead or whether they're alive, according to Buddhism, is a projection of your mind, okay? The reason that you're seeing them as alive is a perception. And the reason that you're seeing them dead is a perception. You see what I mean? So to go from alive to dead only requires what? A shift in your perceptions, okay? And a very slight one. It's like from here to here. God, did you see that? You know? No, it's just like from here to here. It's not a big deal. You see what I mean? If you think of death as being self-existent, if you think of death as being something not empty, if you're not aware of the dependent origination of your arm, then you can't really do a very good death meditation. If you start throwing in emptiness and projections and perceptions from the beginning, you got a real good chance to do a successful death meditation. I'll go over it again, okay? I mean, what makes me see this as alive is something from my mind. Something from my mind is making me see it move, okay? It's not like that I'm deciding to make it move or something like that, all right? You can decide to make it move someday and it won't move. You see what I mean? So it's not a result of your decisions, okay? My karma is making me see something move. My mind collected karma. My karma exists in my mind, and it makes me perceive this thing as moving, okay? And then at some time, like all other energies, what happens to that karma? It wears out, okay? By the way, that's what we call dirty good karma. Okay? There's a difference between dirty good karma and good and pure good karma. But dirty good karma wears out. Okay? I was very happy when I heard this because it explained why I broke up with all my high school girlfriends. You know, I thought I was a bad person. But I was happy to, I was really happy to find out that high school girlfriends are created by dirty good karma. You see what I mean? No, I'm not kidding. I'm really not kidding. So they must wear out. You see what I mean? It must collapse. Okay? And by the way, in the odd event that it doesn't collapse, like my roommate in college, who married his high school girlfriend and spent their lives happily ever after until he slipped in a stream and died, that's the only two ways it can go. Okay? Either you break up before, or by some weird chance, it lasts a while. One party dies, okay? And then it's broken that way. You see, that's the only way it can go. And that's all caused by dirty good karma, okay? Meeting the person, the thrill of the first few days is when the karma is peaking. You see what I mean? And then the karma wears out. And it wears out slowly, or sometimes fast. But anyway, there's a noticeable, you know, things get worse. And then, you know, in the odd circumstance that it's not getting noticeably worse, one party dies or goes away. Okay, so those things, what we call worldly happinesses, are created by what we call dirty good karma. And the lousy thing about worldly happinesses is that they are created by dirty good karma. If they were not, they'd be okay, and we wouldn't have to have Buddhism classes. You see what I mean? If there was a pure good karma that created any one of those relationships, then they would last forever. You see what I mean? They could keep going on the way you think they're going to go on. You see what I mean? So we have to figure out how to collect clean good karma, pure good karma. By the way, that's what creates a Tara. She's a product of pure good karma. Nothing dirty good karma about her. Nothing about her gets old. None of her relationships get worse. Okay? That's a different kind of karma has created that being. And we have to learn how to make that kind of karma. Right now, all the good karmas we have in our karmic pockets are dirty good karmas, and they must wear out. Okay? What's that got to do with dying? The karma that makes you see this thing move is going to shift into a karma that makes you see it not moving. And that's called watching yourself die. Okay? And watching yourself die is nothing other than that. Like, if this was the Heart Sutra, the Buddha would say, there is no life. There is no death. There is no going from life to death. Get it? Okay? Meaning it's not an outside thing that's happening. It's in your perceptions. And your perceptions are being forced on you by your past karma. Okay? In this case, your past good karma. Dirty good karma. What's dirty good karma? Good karma done stupidly. Okay? Good karma done because your school said so, because your father said so, because the law says so, because it feels right. Something like that. Without understanding. Without the perfection of wisdom. Okay? So that's dirty good karma. Things you do right almost by accident. Or because someone told you to do it. Or, you know, or your culture says that's a good thing. Or something like that. But not because you understand it. You see? So that kind of karma has created this body. And the shift must come. You see, when they say, if you're a really good Buddhist, really good Mahayana, Madhyamika, emptiness, middle way Buddhist, you got to think that way about death, okay? Think about it as a shift in your perceptions, which is what it really is. And that, you see, that you can do a heart operation and it's not stopping. You see what I mean? That's not stopping anything. If the heart operation works, it's because you didn't have the karma to die yet. And if the heart operation doesn't work, it's because you did have the karma to die yet. And as once you have the karma to die now, you're going to die now. You can't stop it. Okay? It doesn't matter. You can go to a doctor. You can take vitamins. I always think it's funny. I always tell this story. This is the same boss that wanted the maple syrup. Okay? Hopefully you never meet her. So she takes me to Tokyo. We go on a business trip to Tokyo. We have 2 hours to have this important meeting with a pearl, you know, big pearl supplier, you know. And she says, I got to stop at the beauty shop, you know. And I'm like, you know, so we stop at this. And she says, these are the most amazing cosmetics. You know, they crunch up shells or something and amazing, you know. It makes me look 20 years younger, you know. And I'm like, that's cool. So I'm standing outside. It's like a mall, this huge Japanese mall. And I'm standing outside the store waiting for her. And she goes in. She disappears into the store. And it's like an hour and a half goes by. And, you know, and I'm like ready to fall down. I have to keep standing there because I get in big trouble with this lady if I move, you know. And then it dawned on me that while she was in the store, she got an hour and a half older. You see what I mean? Like all these, you know, maybe some new wrinkles started or, you know, while she was in there to buy the stuff to make her look young, she was getting older. While you're in the health food store, you're getting older. You know, while you're selecting the vitamins to make you younger, you're getting older. You see what I mean? And you can't, it's like that. So anyway, it's a perception. When it's time for that karma to wear out, nothing in the universe can make it stay. Forget it. You know, Lord Buddha, many stories, Lord Buddha at the side of a very good Buddhist, you know, and unable to help them in the least bit not to die. You see, many people were killed within arm's reach of Lord Buddha, and they sought refuge in Lord Buddha and said, protect me. And he said, hey, you know, it's your karma, I don't know. You know, of course, Buddha will try, because that's a bodhisattva vow. But whether they're successful or not to protect you depends totally on your karma. So nobody can stop that. Nobody can stop that karma, okay? What's the proof of that? People die, okay? I mean, if Lord Buddha is compassionate, and if Lord Buddha knows what's going on, which supposedly they're omniscient, Sangye means, you know, omniscient, right? So if they know what's going on, and if they care, then of course they do something, and people wouldn't die. Kids wouldn't be burned in automobile accidents. You know what I mean? Innocent little infants wouldn't be burnt up in tenement houses in New York, you know? I mean, they didn't have time to do anything wrong yet. They just got born, you know what I mean? And then they're burning there. So if Lord Buddha is compassionate, and if Lord Buddha knows about it, which supposedly he knows everything, then why are these kids burning? And it must be that Lord Buddha cannot stop those forces. You see what I mean? Lord Buddha cannot stop your karma. And nobody else can either. Okay? Forget it. If they could, we wouldn't be here, or we'd be younger. You know, if the Dalai Lama could loan us some of his karma, would he do it? Of course. Does he know we need karma? Yes. Okay. But apparently, I mean, the evidence is that it's impossible. It's just impossible. Period. Or people wouldn't die like that. Okay? Or the third possibility, we call Pung Sumba in Tibetan logic. Third possibility. These beings are omniscient, compassionate, I'm sorry, omniscient, omnipotent, and they don't care about us. You know what I mean? That's the, you know, that's when you start feeling like God is like a horse stepping on bugs or something, you know, like they're powerful and they could help us, but they're just not aware of us, or they don't care, and they're just stepping on us by accident, you know, sorry. You know, something like that, you know. I mean, you've ever read Christian books like that. I mean, Christian novels. Novels, Western novels, like, where is God? You know, I feel like a bug being squashed. You know, you don't care about me? You're like a big horse, and I'm like an ant, and you're just riding on us like that. You know, you begin to feel like that. That's not possible. The beings are not like that. Those holy beings, Jesus is not like that. Okay, so if they could help us, they would. And they can't. They can't stop your karma. Your karma will wrap up, and it will finish like that. It's very interesting. If you think of all the good things in your life, the karma, dirty good karma, wears out at a certain rate. Okay? So, you know, I have the karma to have one of my eyes changing now. You know what I mean? And so my good karma to have good eyesight is changing. You know what I mean? And that's wearing out. And then I have another one, you know, maybe I had a nice job for a while and I had a good salary and that wore out. You know what I mean? I had a good sponsor, that wore out. Okay? And they wear out. You see, certain things wear out at a certain rate. Like in December, something wears out. And then in February, something wears out. And it cannot be brought back, you know? I mean, normally. You can go get glasses and the karma has shifted slightly. But the karma to have a healthy young eye is wearing out. And that's the way it goes. Now, think of death as very interesting. It's the simultaneous wearing out of all those karmas. See, if you think it's disappointing to lose your eyesight, your good eyes, or you think it's disappointing to go to menopause or something like that, you know, imagine all of your karmas wearing out in 1 5-minute shot, and that's death. You see what I mean? It's just the fact of a lot of karmas simultaneously wearing out, and then we call that death. And then you can't see this move anymore, okay? So if you find any one of those things upsetting, you know, if it's upsetting to you to have to go to the eye doctor and get glasses or something, then think how upsetting it's going to be to lose all of those parts at once, you know what I mean? And you're going to be that upset. You know, multiply how upset you are to lose your last job times everything you have. And then you're going to do some poet at that moment? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? No, take the upset, multiply it times 500, 1,000, because that's how many pieces of you you're losing. And you know it. And you know you're losing all your family and your friends and all your favorite objects. And then the feeling at that moment is like extreme upset, you know. People tell me, I'm looking forward to death. Death is an adventure, you know. I take them up on a rooftop in New York City, you know, and I get them on the edge and I say, okay, now think. Like, what? You know, and you got to hold on to them real tight, okay? And then you see this reaction, you know, and there's this thing that you fight back. And that's how it is, because you know how much it hurts. From thousands of lifetimes, millions of lifetimes, you know how much it hurts to die. You really do know. Deep inside you, it's there. You know how much it hurts. You remember. That much you remember subconsciously. And people, when they get in a death-threatening situation, they fight, you know, and they'll fight you off. If you have them on the roof and you're like, here, try this, you know, and there's this autonomic, you know, thing where subconsciously you remember how much it hurts and you don't want to do it, you know. Yeah.
Dirty good karma wears out at once.
Yeah.
What kind of karma goes on in your stream?
I said all, but I meant all to be a human in this realm, in this lifetime. So you still have huge karmic pockets, you know. And, you know, it's almost impossible to have no good karmas left at all, okay? I mean, there's something close to that, but it's almost impossible to have no good karmas left at all. You will be able, in the bardo, for example, to understand every kind of language you hear. You'll be able to walk through walls. And there's some parts of the bardo are kind of fun. Later, after the confusing part. And those are good karma. That's a result of good karma. Yeah.
You mentioned that the bad karma, you're using that up where it eventually results in death. What about the flip side of that? If you're getting into doing the proper things, you know, morality and so forth and so on, you could be upscaling or from an investment standpoint increasing your positive karma in such a way. So you could, while one aspect is going on toward a track of death, you're still raising the other portion of it, which is, from what I've read or you shared with us, is talking about your future lifetimes, but it could also affect, I would imagine, your present lifetime. And the example that you were giving of the girlfriends,
well,
that could be, if you were going to the positive end, then you should be increasing positive girlfriends or their last name. I mean, I'm asking that as a question. I don't know if that's...
No, I love the question. Somebody asked me in Australia that question, and I'll phrase it this way. I mean, there's a couple of answers to that.
Session 2 continues on the next CD.